From Television City in Hollywood.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com. The only place to be in your pop culture world.
The following rustic exhibition requires discretionary viewer participation.
Greetings from Allentown is taped in front of a live studio audience.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 85 of Greetings from Allentown. I'm your host, Peter Winson, and today I'll be taking a look at WWF Shotgun Saturday Night from near the end of its run in August of 1999, August 14th to be precise, a rather large week in the history of the World Wrestling Federation for those of you that are familiar with the August 9th, 99 Raw and things going on later that month, such as the launch of a new show on Thursdays. I'm sure I'll have enough time later to get into all of that. Before we get into all that, let me get in my plugs. You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com, facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. Give me a follow on Twitter. My handle is @GFAllentownPod. And you are probably listening to the show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed. And I urge you to check out the all-new ProWrestlingOnly.com. I wonder how long I can actually say the all-new, because it has been about 3 months now since the site was overhauled. But go on to ProWrestlingOnly.com to explore other podcasts on this feed and match reviews features. I was actually reading one of the match reviews earlier today on the Luger Flair match from Wrestle War 90, the one that ended in a count out when Sting got punked on the outside and Luger showed compassion. I always kind of forget about that match in the Flair Luger series that lasted several years. But anyway, retrospectives, reviews of wrestling books, video games and matches, playlists, wrestler appearances in wrestling, non-wrestling TV shows and movies, and more. You can join the conversation by signing up at the Pro Wrestling Only forums. We've been online for over a decade and with over 2,000 registered members and an archive of over 4 million, that's million with an M, threads. Our message board is a vibrant community all its own. Whether you want to talk about a specific match in the match discussion archive, take a deep dive in the microscope form, or discuss more general topics from wrestling's past and present, check that all out at ProWrestlingOnly.com. Been kind of a busy week for me with my job wrapping up, where I'm basically just writing procedures for anybody who comes in to not necessarily my position, but in some position within the group so that they actually know what they're doing. Because there's 10 and a half years of knowledge that's built up in my brain, and it's very hard to just impart all that wisdom. But I just thank God that thank God Donald Trump's a Hulkamaniac. But also, thank God that I wrote a lot of procedures back in 2013 that I basically just have to edit, because otherwise it would have taken me a long time. You could also say, well, Pete, why do you even give a crap? Well, I kind of care that the client is being left high and dry slightly, because they only had me working for that client for a very long time. And I mean, they could switch companies and follow me to my new job, but that's probably not going to happen. I was supposed to go to Chaotic Wrestling last Friday night, and I never made it there with the voice of Greetings from Allentown, Keith Langston. And he got to meet up with Brian Malone. That's the wrestling podcast about nothing. For two people, the largest gathering of Greetings from Allentown listeners of all time, and no, that is not a weight joke or anything like that. I never got there because there's kind of an electricity problem in my house, and I feel free to say this because my wife is out, and she's not going to overhear me saying this or anything. In the living room right now, we had a wall switch replaced because the lights were flickering. And it was because a dimmer was very, very old. It probably was installed at the time that the house was built in the mid-90s. And the dimmer was only good for incandescent bulbs, which you can't get anymore. And I had kind of switching everything over to LEDs. So electrician switches it out, and then the lights are still flickering afterwards for whatever reason. Now, I have not gotten it to replicate what my wife took video of flickering, So, long story short, we're now waiting for the electrician to come back on Wednesday, and we're watching TV in a room that is not the living room, because we are not using the lights in that room. So I've been spending a lot of time in my basement, which is where I am right now, and where I like to record this show the most, because I do think that the sound comes off a little bit better. Not to turn into, you know, Marauder or Mike Crockett or anything like that, but, you know, just obsess over sound. But it seems less echoey to me when I'm in this room as opposed to my dining room table, dining on a bagel, which I don't know if you picked up on. There was a ding that you could hear in the background when I was talking about William Goldberg last week. That was actually my bagel was ready. So that's all that was. Hockey season has started up. That'll kind of change my recording schedule, I think, as well. I've been recording more at night than in the morning more recently. And if I'm going to that, I guess that'll change things. The Boston Bruins had their home opening game on Monday afternoon, so that meant I had to take the day off of work to go to it, because most of us have to work on Columbus Day. I would really like to have a job where I got those more minor holidays off, but that's not going to be the case, I guess, for a while. And I was thinking, in terms of all the rituals that happen at hockey games that are rather strange and are kind of, you know, you wouldn't necessarily maybe see it at a wrestling show per se, but the Bruins scored 6 goals today. And, you know, up where I sit, we all have like this intricate high five of the people you know around you. So my friend Merrill to my left, high five him. Then Mike to his left, and then I turn to the guys in front of me, 2 guys, and then got another guy, Peter, way off to the right. So it's this intricate thing, and I was kind of thinking to myself, and I don't know why I would think something like this, because it's really not my scene. I thought, with all the slappings of hands that's going on in here, this would be like the most logical place to have a drug deal go down anywhere and have it just happen discreetly, because nobody would see what's going on at all. Like, nobody would see the exchange of money or maybe a small stash of something. I don't know. Maybe it has. I mean, you got to get it into the building, but it's not like when you go through a metal detector, it's not like they're, you know, tracking down for weed or any other narcotics. I don't know why this popped into my head at today's game. I mean, I think about weird stuff because having gone to probably 700 Bruins games by now, I think of weird stuff to just kind of entertain myself, because I've decided that I've seen it all at these games ever since I saw a puck go through the little photographer's hole that you put, like, you can put like the lens of a camera up against. It's basically the size of a puck, maybe about 110% the size of a puck, and I saw a puck go through it. And once I saw that, I realized that I'd seen anything. But so yes, I'm going to hockey, and I skipped going to wrestling, once again proving that I am a terrible wrestling fan. But now on to 1999 WWF, which I am very thankful for. As I record this, it's Canadian Thanksgiving, so happy belated Thanksgiving to everybody up there. Down here we have Columbus Day, whatever the hell that is at this point. I can look back on 99 and say, boy, I have definitely grown as a human being, because back then I watched it religiously. I have mentioned in the past that I used to watch Shotgun Saturday Night because it was WWF programming on free TV, and I did not have cable in my dorm room. And I didn't ever have cable in my dorm room, but I had greater access to it as time went along. But in the summertime, you're able to actually watch these sort of things. So I probably did not see this show, this very historic show, for reasons that I'll get into, when it originally aired. And I enjoyed it at the time, and I probably went over this in the other 1999 show that I did, a Halftime Heat, almost a year ago now. But I was also a different kind of fan who did not care about the long-term future of professional wrestling, the old saying of, well, what are you going to do next week? Except for back then, I was always very worried about what I called move inflation, about how I would point out that the DDT was now this move that you could never get a pin on, whereas in the 80s, it was a finisher for any number of guys. I was actually yelling about that back then. So maybe I showed signs of kind of evolving into the fan that I am today. And 99 was a year where I myself did a lot of stupid stuff in my own life that I don't necessarily want to relive. And WWF did a lot of stupid stuff in 1999 that I don't particularly want to rewatch. As you go through it, you got the worst Royal Rumble that of that era, and it's not even close. It was a terrible match from pretty much from start to finish. You got chair shots to the head everywhere, which is just brutal to watch. I don't know what it is. It's certainly not just Benoit. It's way more prevalent in watching 1999 WWF to prepare for the show than even I had thought. WrestleMania 15, horrible WrestleMania. I would even mark it worse than, say, WrestleMania 9, which always gets demerits as being one of the worst ones ever. You got Billy Gunn as the King of the Ring, kind of a symbol of, yeah, we're trying to push a new guy, but does it really have to be this guy? And, of course, goes without saying, the Owen Hart tragedy in the month of May, and then out of that, you end up getting that horrific Jeff Jarrett character where he's abusing women and just hitting people with guitars and all that. But the more people were watching it in 1999 than ever before. It was such a pop culture phenomenon. I remember wrestlers being on the cover of TV Guide when TV Guide actually mattered. Even though that there was a program guide on most cable systems, I would imagine, back then, people still subscribed to TV Guide. And just thinking of the audience back then and just how huge it was, and me being 20 years old at the time, I was kind of trying to come up with a thought exercise about the year of birth of wrestling fans. I would love to know. And let's just take people age 50 and under. So let's say 1968 and in as an example. I would love to know the percentage of wrestling fans by birth year and whether you do have a spike in, let's say, 1975 to 1980, or even, you know, bleed that over into 1984. People who were teenagers or young adults during the Attitude Era, how many of them eventually stayed? Of course, a lot of them went away after 2001. I just really kind of interested in that, because there's a lot of talk now about the Monday Night Raw audience being older than what you would think. And that kind of demographic thing just kind of interests me in sort of thinking about it. But back in 99, while the product isn't necessarily the most rewatchable thing, I don't sit down and watch Monday Night Raws or the early SmackDowns from this era. There is Austin, who in 99, the shine is starting to come off a little bit because now you're in the third year of that run. But you also have The Rock, who's only in about year two of his run. He's a red-hot babyface when he turns about a month, month and a half after WrestleMania 15. And Mick Foley, kind of at the peak of his powers through the entire calendar year, covers up a lot of deficiencies, along with, of course, Vince McMahon and his Mr. McMahon character. Goes without saying that he was certainly great, even if it brought us Shane McMahon and Stephanie McMahon, which, in my opinion, not all that great. They're kind of like a basketball team relying on a couple of guys who are mega superstars, but really don't have much of a bench. But the crowd was reacting to it. This is just all kind of 2020 hindsight for me. So if people are reacting to all these mid-carders, I suppose it's fine, even if I disagree with how things were going on a week-to-week basis. Now, I had mentioned that this was a huge week, and they're leading in to the SummerSlam 1999 pay-per-view to be held in Minneapolis, Minnesota at the Target Center. This was the week of Chris Jericho's debut, as you probably picked up from the intro to the show. Jesse Ventura, on that famous August 9th, 99 Raw, returns and does a promo in the ring. He would be the special guest referee for what was planned as Steve Austin versus Triple H for the WWF World Heavyweight title. There was no Mick Foley yet, and there was yet another twist that would happen between this point and the SummerSlam event itself. And SmackDown started at month end, a show that I don't want to say that this killed Shotgun Saturday Night, because Shotgun lost a lot of its oeuvre when it switched to just a regular arena taping back in March of 1997, which I covered in episode 13 of Greetings from Allentown. That was actually the first one that they moved out of the nightclubs and all that and just kind of taped it before Raw or after Sunday Night Heat. SmackDown debuts later in the month. Shotgun goes away. It would be replaced by WWF Jacked. And this episode here, it's not the final episode of Shotgun. It's the penultimate episode of Shotgun, which always kind of reminds me of, you had the Ultimate Warrior and his nuttiness over his character and trademark issues and that sort of stuff. I always had this great idea that you create a character, and maybe it's somewhat of a parody character, maybe it's somewhat of a comedy character, I don't know, but I would create a character called the Penultimate Warrior. Now, don't worry, there's going to be one more warrior after this guy. He's not the final one. You're going to get one more after him. And to kind of create a little bit more of a dig to the warrior, I would make the character gay as well, because that ain't what Jim Hellwig would have wanted, I can assure you. Now, the matches on this show were taped in Detroit at the Joe Louis Arena on August the 8th, which was after the Sunday Night Heat live show that aired from there on that night. And the matches we do have on this program, Edge and Christian are taking on the remnants of the corporate ministry, Midian and Viscera. Ken Shamrock is taking on Chaz, but not the Chaz that I'm thinking of. It's a different Chaz. I don't know why I'm thinking of the different Chaz. It's probably just my own experience as a fan. A six-man match with Draz, Prince Albert, not in a can, and a friend of theirs named Key, which I think I'll have a few things to say about that. And then finally, Steve Blackman will wrap up our show today. We have a rather interesting commentary team for Shotgun Saturday Night, which I will get into after the break, where I play the biggest sports moment of the year, 1985, which somebody, and I forget who it was on my Facebook page or in one of the comments, correctly predicted what it would actually be. So, sports moment from 1985.
Well, this is spring training all over again. Any ball to the right side, you get there as quick as you can. I think he tries to go for the ball. His argument is he gets the side of the bag. Looks like he's out.
From that angle, let's take a look from this one.
Again, Clark with the toss.
Oh, yes.
If that play happens today, it is immediately overturned on a video review that wouldn't have taken very long, because Orta was clearly out at first base. Worrell got his foot on the bag. He caught the ball properly. Now, with that said, this is Game 6 of the 1985 World Series. The Cardinals are ahead 3-2. They're up 1-0. He's the leadoff hitter in the bottom of the ninth. Even with him reaching base successfully there in error by the umpire Don Denkinger, one of the most infamous blown calls in baseball history, the win probability for the Royals only goes to 34% from that. It's all what happens in the aftermath of that play. Now, maybe emotions were running wild, but the fact is that Todd Worrell gave up the order chop, but that was on an 0-2 pitch, and yes, he should have been out. Steve Balboni, he singles, 0-2 pitch, couldn't put him away. Next, you have a bunt, and they are unable to actually move the runner, so you still have runners at first and second. Passed ball on the catcher and the next hitter, so then the runners end up at second and third anyway, which leads to an intentional walk, and then a single by the next hitter, Dane Eorg, gets two runs in, wins the game for the Royals, and they easily win game seven of that series the next night. Score of that game, I think, was 11-0. But the thing that I remember the most, and this will never happen again, I could watch 100 more World Series go to a Game 7, and I am pretty sure I will never see a manager get ejected from a Game 7 the way Whitey Herzog did. Pitcher Joaquin Andujar also got ejected as well. But by that point, it was, I think, 11-0 or 9-0 or something like that. The game was completely out of hand. And for those who are like, well, why didn't you pick the Lakers beating the Celtics in 85? I would say Celtics already beat the Lakers at the quote-unquote big pay-per-view in the 84 finals. 85 was like Backlash, okay? No, nobody cares about what happens at Backlash, all right? It's the old Triple H thing. So our commentary team, as I had said, is a rather fascinating one, at least to me, because it's a mix of old and new, so I guess. Michael Cole alongside Michael Hayes, who is not Michael P.S. Hayes, but at least he is freed from that prison he was living in as Doc Hendricks. Ironically, you could say he was doxed by none other than Vince Russo on an episode of Live Wire a couple of years before, but they didn't let him be Michael Hayes until, I want to say 99, because this is when he starts managing the Hardy Boys, and more on that in a little bit. Now, if you'll indulge me, I want to read a few results of the Sunday Night Heat show from August 8th, which is taped on the same night as this episode of Shotgun, because as I was reading through it, it struck me as a quintessential 1999 WWF show, so you be the judge. Val Venis defeated WWF Intercontinental and European Champion D'Lo Brown via disqualification when Jeff Jarrett, who did guest commentary for the match, attacked the challenger. After the bout, Jarrett and Brown brawled, only the IC title was on the line. Tori pinned Les Lexi. After the bout, WWF Women's Champion Ivory attacked Tori and wrote slut on her stomach and skank on her back. WWF Tag Team Champions, the Acolytes, fought Kane and the Road Dogg to a no contest. The Godfather fought Albert with draws to a no contest when draws Albert and the fan that attacked the Godfather on Raw triple teamed him until Val Venus and Chaz made the save. The Big Boss Man pinned Meat with Terry Reynolds after the bout. Boss Man assaulted Meat with the nightstick until Terry helped him out of the ring. The Undertaker pinned Billy Gunn with the Tombstone at 3:38 after The Rock, who did guest commentary for the bout, repeatedly punched Gunn in the face as he was on the mat. Moments later, Rock was being assaulted by Show on the floor before being thrown into the ring where both Taker and Show beat Rock down. So there is Sunday Night Heat from August of 99. Oh my God. I suppose I could rewatch that, but I also could rewatch Mama's Family, and I have no intention of doing that. So as they open the show, the Goth Shield, Edge and Christian make their way down, freed from Gangrel and the Brood for their match. They're making their way down the aisle, the same way the Shield seems to be doing once again, because they just can't find their way to the back, I presume. I liked Edge less the more I saw him as a character as it went along. The first edition of the Edge character, Edge 1.0, I liked the most. Back when he was the random dude who came through the crowd and then also helped Sable at SummerSlam 98, for whatever reason that was, I can't exactly remember. Edge's smile is so weird. It kind of reminds me of Beavis, or Beavis and Butthead, as if I have to, you know, differentiate him from other Beavises, but he's so pointy. I mean, yeah, that's probably why he got the name Edge, but he's like Ricky Schroeder after Silver Spoons. I don't know if you remember, when Ricky Schroeder got older, his face became like almost like granite, like he was the old man of the mountain in New Hampshire, at least until it fell down. And what I do enjoy, though, is that somebody agrees with me, and it's Michael Hayes.
Why do the girls like Edge? I mean, seriously, he's stupid. I mean, look at his face. Stupidity just reeks from him.
And then Hayes says, speaking of stupid, as Midian and Viscera make their way to the ring. He was really kind of giving it to both sides. He was a heel announcer who didn't even like the heels all that much from what I could gather. But maybe Michael was in a bit of a foul mood because on that very busy August 9th Raw, he was also turned on by the Hardy Boys, who he had managed for a few months up to that point to kind of provide, you know, a mouthpiece for Jeff and Matt. I mean, they would never learn how to cut promos, right? But having Michael Hayes with them gave them a certain kind of credibility. So maybe he was a little sour about that.
And a lot has transpired in your life over the past 6 days here in the World Wrestling Federation. The Hardy Boys dissing you on national television.
Hello, didn't I just tell you before we went on the air, don't go there? I didn't want to talk about it. What makes you think anything has changed?
Well, I want to know what happened. This once blossoming relationship between you and Jeff and Matt has gone out the window.
Well, look, everybody will know about my retaliation when it happens. The first people to know will be Matt and Jeff. Now just leave it alone.
Don't go there.
Yeah, Hayes is in a really sour mood. In fact, he even says that he'll shoot himself if he has to work with Michael Cole anymore. And this isn't even like super annoying 2011 Michael Cole. This is like regular, young, still learning Michael Cole. The Hardys would go on to join the New Brood, which didn't work because it has the word new in it, and that does not work in wrestling, hardly ever. And the New Day is the exception that proves the rule because there was no Old Day, at least until that horrible skit with Gallows and Anderson that we all really like to forget about. Slam and a hip toss by Edge on Midian, obviously. He wasn't doing that on Viscera, although Viscera does get tagged in, and as I'm looking at Edge and Viscera facing off, I'm thinking just a couple of guys who were Kings of the Ring at various points in their career. Viscera in 1995, and Edge would win that in 2001, but he does tag Christian into the match as Cole and Hayes talk about way too much other stuff. They're jumping all around and just trying to, it's like they're trying to do an episode of This Week in WWE, but like within the context of just this one match. There's so much going on in this one week in the WWF that it's impossible to really kind of sum it up. It's like, let it breathe. Just call the match in front of you. Corner mount punches by Christian on Viscera, who just sort of carries him out into the center of the ring and in a bear hug. I was expecting an inverted atomic drop, but that would seem like something weird to come from a 500-pound guy. A double drop kick by Edge and Christian. And Edge goes for a sunset flip on Viscera, who looks pretty bad even for him. I mean, the poor guy was so heavy, but going for a sunset flip on a 500-pound guy is something I'll always enjoy because it'll make me think of Tito Santana trying to do it to Andre the Giant at Survivor Series 88, and him just getting sat on rather comically. Christian tries to help out, but he actually gets backdropped by Viscera, who then tries a sit-down splash, but that misses. He hits nothing but canvas. And Edge goes at Midian for a second for some reason. He's just kind of on the apron minding his own business. And when he turns back to Viscera, he is met with a Samoan drop. At this point in the match, I'm noticing Viscera is wearing a jacket, and I don't understand why the 500-pound guy needs to wear a jacket in the middle of August during his matches. I mean, I know it's probably like a light coat, but what the hell was going on? I mean, could he ever have like a normal outfit? I guess it's really hard when you're 500 pounds. So obviously Edge is in peril. As that happens, they continue talking about other stuff going on. And there's questions now about the relationship between Triple H and China.
You know, Triple H and China have been so close in the past, but we understand Triple H is furious after China picked up the victory this past week on Raw.
Spit it out. You want to know if they slept together after Raw, right?
Yeah, basically.
See, that's what I thought about you. You're a little pervy.
Well, I doubt they did. I mean, you have to be honest with that.
This is not related to any sort of Triple H China Stephanie McMahon triangle. That's not until later in the year. This is in reference to China actually winning the number one contendership for the WWF World Heavyweight title on the Raw the previous Monday in a triple threat match with The Undertaker and Triple H. Yes, The Undertaker and Triple H, who had a match in Australia just this past week, and I have not watched it as I am taping this, but having seen some of the highlights and the reviews of it, I am pretty confident that I don't want to watch it. So China won the match because Steve Austin came down, hit Triple H in the square in the head with a chair, because Austin had been put out earlier. The original match was Austin versus Triple H versus Undertaker. And then for some reason, the number one contendership was put up by Commissioner Shawn Michaels, who actually looked like a normal human being until he was assigned to referee said triple threat match, and then he had to wear his ridiculous-looking shorts. So technically, at that point in time, you have Stone Cold Steve Austin versus China as your main event. And that would change later when you would have China lose to Mankind via Mandible Claw, and then Mankind would have a double pin situation with Triple H, setting up the triple threat for SummerSlam, because Steve Austin wasn't going to lose to Triple H, and also because Jesse Ventura did not want to raise the hand of a heel as the governor of Minnesota at that time. Viscera with the leg drop on Edge, and I give him credit, he did not break Edge's face, although the fact that it is carved out of granite probably helped, and only a two count. Midian misses a forearm from the middle rope. Cole decides to bring up the Hardy Boys thing again to twist the knife on Hayes, and Michael decides to provide a commentary on raising kids in that day and age.
Well, you know, that's the trouble with kids today. They have no respect, they have no appreciation, and the reason why is because of people like you. Parenting is not done right anymore. You parents don't know how to raise your kids.
Cole asks what that had to do with anything, but what he's missing is that he was like a father-like figure to the Hardys. So to have that happen to him kind of upsets him, and kind of. But I do like him on commentary here, because he's different from the usual Lawler, you know, his whole shtick at the time, and certainly better than the Shane McMahon yelling and screaming the entire match. Hot tag to Christian, who's in with Viscera, and Edge stupidly gets back in the ring after he'd been beat down for a few minutes, and gets hit with an avalanche by Viscera. And Christian hits the slop drop on Midian, which I found kind of ironic, you know, given that he comes from a Godwin's background. And then he is caught by Viscera, Christian is, and Edge pushes Viscera down because Midian was, like, behind his legs. So the old trip technique, 1, 2, 3, this match was very blah. Even though Edge and Christian are a very solid and talented tag team that is going to rank highly in the Place to Be Nation greatest WWE tag team ever poll, and they'll probably make my top 20 or 25 for sure, but Viscera in this match, he looked really bad, even for him. So it's interesting that the best performer in this match was probably Michael Hayes, of all people.
WWF referees are trained to be impartial, maintain composure, and by all means, stay out of harm's way. Yeah, right.
I have the power.
Jesse the Body Ventura returns to the ring for an out-of-body experience.
It's the body rules. It's my rules or the highway.
WWF SummerSlam, presented live by Chef Boyardee, next Sunday on pay-per-view.
The world will get shot.
One of the things I really like about doing the show, where I jump around to different eras, different promotions, is that it provides me an excuse to watch certain things that I ordinarily wouldn't, like, let's say, a SummerSlam 99. But I'm here to say that I did not rewatch this in preparation for this show, because I don't think I could make it. It might have broken me, especially because, you know, I would have had to go the full 3 hours. Although I do sometimes pass over matches that I don't really need to watch, like with Spring Stampede 99. Last week, which I watched in preparation, I did skip over the Benoit Malenko tag match and a couple of others, just so I could kind of get a feel for the whole show. But the story of SummerSlam 1999 was the return of Jesse the Body Ventura, who did a promo segment on the previous Raw, and as they're promoting that appearance or clips of that on Shotgun, they keep billing it as Jesse's Law, which I get it. He's an official. He's going to be laying down the law in the match. But when I see Jesse apostrophe S, it only makes me think of one thing, and that's Jesse's Girl by Rick Springfield. You know I wish I had Jesse's Law. I wish that I had Jesse's Law. Why can't I find a governor like that? Jesse's tenure as governor went about how you would expect it to go for a third-party candidate of the Reform Party, which he then later left. The two parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, basically just ganged up on him as kind of a payback for defeating their chosen candidates in the 1998 gubernatorial election. It didn't really work. I liked Jesse's politics to an extent at the time because I found him to be somewhat libertarian. He was fiscally conservative, where they were running a budget surplus, as most states in the federal government was at the end of the 90s. So he promised to return surpluses to the taxpayers. But he was very sort of liberal on social issues. It was the 9/11 attacks that really made him crazy and into the conspiracy theories. He was always a little off kilter, but it was that event that kind of made him into what people think of him as today. I know at the end of his term, he had to appoint a senator when Senator Paul Wellstone, who was up for re-election shortly thereafter, died in a plane crash. And originally, he was going to appoint a Democrat to serve out the rest of the term, but then the memorial for Paul Wellstone turned a little too political, too much of a political rally, so he nominated a fellow member of the Reform Party, or what was the Reform Party in Minnesota. Remember in that 02 Senate race, they replaced Wellstone with Fritz Mondale, and they dubbed, because he only had 10 days to campaign, they dubbed his kind of last-minute campaigning as the, quote, Fritz Blitz, which is always great because you definitely want to evoke memories of Nazi Germany when you're sending people to the polls. He did lose the election to Norm Coleman, who would lose 6 years later to Al Franken, and we all know how that kind of went. Jesse ended up meeting Bill Clinton shortly before this aired. They were plugging that on the Raw. And he was a hot name at the time. With it being in Minnesota, it certainly made sense to bring him in. And for a fan like me, it is a nice little callback to the first SummerSlam in 1988, where he also served as a referee. And it had been 5 years since you saw him on WCW programming as a color commentator. Hulk Hogan shows up, and then shortly thereafter, Jesse is on his way out the door. But as he proved with his promo in the ring on that Monday night in Chicago, Rosemont, Illinois, at the Allstate Arena, he proved that he could still bring it, as The Rock would say.
We all know who is the power in Minnesota. And we all know, why did the World Wrestling Federation come to Jesse the Body Ventura for a match of this magnitude, a World Heavyweight Championship match? Because they know I am the only person who can deliver law and order to where a champion will be decided in the center of the ring, and that champion will truly be the best wrestler in the World Wrestling Federation.
At this point, Triple H interrupts and his music starts playing. And Jesse, you can tell he's not entirely used to the way that they would set up these sort of things, because he kind of keeps talking even after the music hits and tries to keep talking over it. So in the ring, we have a little 1994 WCW reunion of Jesse, who was doing color commentary on WCW Worldwide, and his old pal Terror Rising, who I covered back in episode 23.
This is not Minnesota. This is my world. This right here, where your two little feet are standing, dead center in the middle of what is my ring.
King, You better explain to him that this is my country, which is bigger than your ring.
I don't care who you are, and I don't care who you've got with you. If right here in the middle of this ring, I feel like kicking your ass, I will.
Triple H cares not for your patriotism or whatever. This is a man who does business with the Saudi government, who recently murdered an exiled journalist in the consulate in Turkey. That's a story that really kind of bugs me, but I do like to keep this show light. And Shawn Michaels eventually interrupts, dressed like a human being, like I said before, and as I had mentioned, he does the triple threat match with Austin, who was originally supposed to be. Shawn fingered Triple H as the one who had injured Austin, so he replaced Austin in the match with China. When they showed Austin laid out and hurt, it was by some steps, and Jesse suggested, oh, I've seen Austin have a few beers, maybe he fell down the stairs and hurt himself that way. It was a classic Jesse moment where he's jumping into these storylines seemingly midstream, but he feels like he's always been there because he is so that character that he is at the commentary desk. I also want to say that Jesse would have been a really good authority figure had that sort of thing existed when he was in the wrestling business. I mean, I know he's so far out of it now and he's living in Mexico, but I don't know, perhaps CMLL could use an authority figure. I don't know if Jesse actually speaks Spanish, but it's kind of interesting. But Triple H, once again, being the benevolent man that he is, having married Stephanie McMahon years later, the woman who would invent women's wrestling out of whole cloth. Here are his thoughts on China getting the spot in the number one contenders match, showing some real support for women in pro wrestling.
Enough is enough. All due respect, China's just a girl. So I put her in this spot, Sean, because she could get hurt. This is serious business. This is for the number one contender slot. No place for a woman.
My commentary on Triple H might be unfair because I'm judging him by 2018 standards in 1999, but it's just very interesting to look back, given the events now with WWE and Saudi Arabia. It just kind of, I mean, they also believe that there's no place for a woman in a number one contenders match, or pretty much anywhere else. Shawn's music hits at the end of it, which I may hate Shawn Michaels, but Shawn's music would always make me laugh just because of how unbelievably ridiculous it was, especially as he got older. And my whole bit in college would be I would get up on a chair whenever he would, whenever his music would hit, and I would dance on the chair because he did that once on the announce table on a 98 Raw, and I thought that that was really funny. One of the few things that I enjoy with Shawn Michaels. And they do show a clip of the triple threat match, Michaels in the ridiculous shorts. But the thing that struck me the most, it's really weird hearing Jesse Ventura call an Undertaker match and calling it straight up. Like I said, as if he had always been there, because he leaves in 1990, 3 months before Undertaker ever shows up. So they never crossed at all. So Austin, chair to the head of Triple H, puts China on top, and now we get the Austin versus China graphic that they show on the screen that I tweeted out a few days ago, billed as the main event for SummerSlam 99, because we're still evolving this storyline to the next episode of Raw, and I'm going to spare you with Austin facing a woman. I'm going to spare you any sort of commentary on Austin hitting a woman.
Hey now, you're an all-star. Get your game on, go play. Hey now, you're a rock star. Get the show on, get paid.
And all that women are gold.
Only shooting stars break the mold.
All-Star by Smash Mouth was the number one song that week in 1999. As I recall, I believe I had the same facial hair as the lead singer of Smash Mouth at that time. I kind of got made fun of for it. Also in the Abe Lincoln sense, because it was like the thin all the way down to the chin, and then it was kind of like a regular goatee at that point, as I recall, anyway. I was always convinced that they wrote that song All Star just so that they could get invited to play at All Star games. Like the 1999 All-Star game at Fenway Park, where they actually either played on the day of the game or they were there for the Home Run Derby the day before and, of course, performed that song. For the next bout, we have two guys whose stars had really faded in the WWF over the previous couple of years. We have Chaz taking on Ken Shamrock. And first on Chaz, I had said that it was not the Chaz that I was looking for. Kind of like I was Kenobi playing a mind trick. But anyway, when you say Chaz in wrestling, the first one that I think of is actually Chaz Taylor from Global Wrestling Federation in 1991. It seems weird that I would think of him before Chaz, the Attitude Era guy who was once Thrasher in the Headbangers. By the way, the Headbangers as a team, it was a fun team in 97 and into 98. However, they came along a few years too late. If they were about 5 years older, I think that they would have fit very nicely into that smoking guns position that was held in the much of the mid-90s. Take his 1999. Charles Warrington is his name, so that's where you get Chaz from. His 1999 is beyond the pale. He starts off as a headbanger. And then he is repackaged because Mosh got hurt. So how do you repackage him? Do you make him just say like a Man Mountain Rock type musician? No, we're going to make him the ridiculous Beaver Cleavage, for which there were a couple of vignettes where it would be in black and white and he would have a full-breasted mom, you know, oh, do you want some mother's milk with your cereal and stuff like that. Stuff that I guess would play well at the time, but now just seems, well, I think it's really ick in any sort of era. But here's, try this one on. When do you think his first match was? It was at the May 25th Raw taping. So, you're going to debut this guy in this gimmick 2 days after Owen Hart falls to his death. I know they had resumed normalcy as much as they possibly could 2 days afterwards because they're taping the Raw for the following Monday. But, my God, couldn't you have pushed it off a little bit? Especially since, you know, who the hell thought that this was going to work anyway? Why couldn't he have stayed as Mosh? And by the way, I know I'm getting myself confused with the Headbangers. I feel like I'm turning into Jesse Ventura or Gorilla Monsoon, not being able to tell the Rougeos or Demolition apart because it's fairly obvious. Also, my notes are very messy. If you've seen my handwriting, I've posted on the Twitter. Sometimes what I wrote down can be hard to decipher. So this ridiculous character. So how do you get out of a character like that? Well, it's 1999 and Vince Russo was there. So of course we're going to do a worked shoot where he says that he didn't want to be in that type of gimmick. So now he just becomes Chaz and he's got the mother from those vignettes, Mariana, at his side. Kind of funny that her name was Mariana because that was pretty much the Mariana Trench of Mosh's entire career. So he gets a bit of a minor. This is the most minor push you could possibly get, if you'd even consider it that. He beat Meat on several occasions. He beat Meat, and he did it in public several times, but mostly he would end up on the losing end of his bouts before coming back as Mosh in October. I really can't get over how they did a parody of a show, Leave It to Beaver, that went off the air when John F. Kennedy was president. And it's not like in 1999 there was a lot of nostalgia for that sort of thing. Everybody was sort of in that moment. That is what the era, Attitude Era was, for better or worse, and to my mind, probably for worse. Now, Ken Shamrock, on the other hand, not exactly faring that much better. Certainly, he's firmly in the mid-card, but he had actually been sliding down after his ill-fated heel run less than a year earlier. He's preparing for a Lion's Den match with Steve Blackman, who he's feuding with at this point. The Lion's Den match, I liked the way they did it in 1998 with the match with Owen. Even though they did Irish whips and stuff like that, the match was entertaining in and of itself, which I think owes a little bit to Owen Hart. And it followed up the dungeon match that they did in Stu Hart's dungeon the month before at Fully Loaded. This one was a little bit lacking because it wasn't the first one, and it was, you know, more of a weapons match than what the Owen and Shamrock was. It was almost like a wrestling match in a sort of different environment. But the thing that was interesting to me is that was Ken Shamrock's last pay-per-view appearance for the WWF, because he would return to MMA, and that would be a very ill-fated return for him, because he comes in 1997 into the WWF billed as the world's most dangerous man. And he could lay claim to that, being a former UFC super fight champion. And in fact, when he turned back to pro wrestling in 1997, his record in MMA, which was achieved between the ages of 29 and 32, was 23 wins, 5 losses, and 2 draws. Not bad. In fact, a very good record. When he goes back to MMA after leaving the WWF in 1999, not long after this, his record is 5-12 and 0 draws between the ages of 36 and 52. Now, these recent matches with, I remember the Kimbo Slice one being particularly appalling, because neither guy should have been let anywhere near an octagon at the time. Chaz's gear is mildly interesting. He's got a big smiley face on the front of it, which I'm not sure that really adds a whole lot to his credibility. But, you know, we do have Michael Hayes, who's still angry from earlier. And Cole and Hayes, they kind of take a shot here at reliving, trying to do the Bobby Heenan, Gorilla Monsoon classic sort of exchange.
Now, let me get this straight. Chaz has got a smiling face on his groin, and Mariana's missed his half her pants.
Well, the other half are still in my hotel room.
Please!
What?
Will you stop?
You don't believe me?
No, I don't.
Okay.
Gorilla passed away only 2 months after this, so it's nice to hear something of a tribute on a show like this, so close to what would be his passing. Chaz tries a double leg takedown like a complete idiot on Shamrock. If I was thinking from a kayfabe perspective of how to approach Shamrock, I don't think I would be trying to do that. But he eventually does get a two count in a pinning combination.
And what's Chaz's deal? I mean, he said he's sick and tired of all these gimmicks, being headbangers, nuns, spiders. He just wants to be a kid from New Jersey.
I'm not sure how good of a gimmick that is, but it's working for Joe Morana and Michael Quinn of the Our Vantage Point podcast, so who am I to judge? I just know the Bruce Springsteen trying to get out of New Jersey, Born to Run, where he's wrote a number of songs about leaving the state. I'm a little bit more familiar with that. Leg lock by Shamrock, but then we have a rope break, and then he follows it up with an armbar double leg takedown, and Steve Blackman wakes his way out, but he doesn't come down the ramp. He's just kind of watching at the top, checking things out, scouting like it's championship wrestling in Poughkeepsie in 1984. Where you just wander down to ringside, and that's how you kind of, you know, advance the angle, just kind of staring at what's going on. Shamrock with a Hurricanrana, not exactly the greatest looking move, and Chaz takes a powder on the outside, where he regains some semblance of control as he sends Shamrock's head into the ring steps. But back inside, Chaz makes a cardinal mistake for a ring veteran. Yes, he puts his head down, and Shamrock does a rather interesting move, and I like the finish here, which is a sunset flip where he doesn't go for the pin. Instead, as he rolls through on the sunset flip, he grabs the ankle and locks in the ankle lock and picks up the victory that way. Stuff like that, where you take a simple move and then you kind of roll through into a submission, always going to get the thumbs up from me. Even though Shamrock, I don't know when he would have given his notice to the WWF, but he starts losing to Blackman after SummerSlam, where he did pick up the victory in the Lion's Den, and eventually enters into a brief feud with Chris Jericho on SmackDown, and it seems that he was written off TV as being injured at the hands of Chris Jericho's short-term bodyguard, Mr. Hughes. So, not just a footnote, Mr. Hughes, for all of his various short appearances in the WWF in 93, 97, and 99. Yes, he is an actual part of a storyline that wrote off a character who made an impact for a couple of years in the late 90s.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero and Chad Kimball here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com. And we now offer them to you on two great feeds. The Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, Main Event, Survey Says, Wrestling Warzone, and Monday Night Wars podcast retrospective, No Holds Barred, Jeff Learns Wrestling, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. On top of that, we're also dipping into the vault, re-releasing the entire catalog of Where the Big Boys Play for your enjoyment. And in addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is loaded with great content, offering such tremendous shows covering the land of pop culture, such as Geek and Sassy, Talkin' Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Sunday Groove, PTB In Play, Freak Out Drive-In, Songs with Friends, Looking Forward, Looking Back, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Conversation Comics, DC Post Crisis Management, Marvel Age, and Marvel Age Masterclass, plus weekly pod blasts that cover the gamut of comic topics. The feed is also filled with insightful sports content, including the NBA team, This Week in the NFL, and more.
And you can find all these current shows, plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well, by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows, plus others, available at PlayStation.com. We cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon while doing your online shopping, and download our free BTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebook via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Know that Pro Wrestling Only is separate from Place to Be Nation now, but I'm still going to play that ad because I do make appearances on the Place to Be podcast when they are doing Saturday night's main event. So next one won't be for a little while. They covered the September 1988 MSG house show. So the next Saturday night's main event would be October of 88. I think that is scheduled for the first week in November. So just keep all those shows in mind as well, of course, with the usual Pro Wrestling Only roster of shows as well. And while I'm here, I might as well sneak in my plugs for other podcasts. On the Our Vantage Point podcast, they look at UWF Fury from November of 1990. I saw a couple of UWF shows have been posted. I'm not sure I can make the leap to cover one of those in any sort of depth soon, but I am looking to do more weird and different stuff in the future. On the Wrestling Podcast About Nothing with Mike Crockett and Brian Malonis, they kind of take a comparison of the wrestling industry now, so something of a State of the Union, and comparing it with the past. And on the Sportscasters with my sometimes podcast partner Steve Bennett, he has on fantasy sports guru Matthew Berry. So something of a Syracuse University hoedown in that one. So be sure to check out those shows on their various feeds. At the top of the show, you heard Chris Jericho in his debut as the Millennium Man, the big countdown clock that had gone on for several weeks prior. And that was just such a brilliant concept to kind of build anticipation, even for smart fans that knew what was coming. The fact that you set a countdown clock and you could figure it out to the moment of, you better be watching at 9:22 p.m. Eastern Time, or whatever time it was when he actually rolled onto the scene. It was a great way to introduce a character memorably without him tripping over a piece of wood and his helmet falling off. Because you remember the Shockmaster and you remember Chris Jericho for just memorable debuts. Yeah, sure, there's Scott Hall coming through the crowd on Nitro that's been played time and again, but those two, I don't know, if you ask me to name a memorable debut, those are actually probably the first ones that I would come up with. It had actually been a while since Jericho was on television for WCW. His last appearance was the April 5th of 99 Nitro, which is actually the same week as the show that I covered last week. He was very frustrated in WCW, as you might imagine, given that despite some of the great things that he was coming up with, he was never going to rise above the level of a TV champion. His departure was a really big blow from the perspective of the entertainment on a Nitro really wasn't there. And when Jericho was out there, especially when that character was really coming into its own in early 1998, where he goes into the conspiracy victim stuff, where he's standing in Washington, D.C. when they had Nitro there, and he would film these vignettes, and he would have a great deal of leeway in what he would be able to create. So the fact that he was able to create such great things there, you think, well, now he's in the WWF. You got these great expectations. What's he going to do now working with the people that created Steve Austin and The Rock and the rest? For that night at the Allstate Arena, Jericho talks about it in his first book. So I'm going to read an excerpt of that and then of something else that happened on that same evening. The next morning when I arrived at the Allstate Arena in Chicago, I suited up in my new Y2J costume of a pair of Harley Davidson leather pants and a silver rave shirt that I bought from a hip-hop shop. I was taking Jimmy Hart's darling advice of wearing color to the max. Besides, I had a lot to live up to if I was going to dub myself, quote, the most charismatic showman to ever enter your living room via a television screen. I put my hair into the Gene Simmons top knot, combed the Billy Goat beard that I'd grown for the occasion, looked in the mirror and gave myself a Billy Idol sneer. Y2J had arrived, mother truckers. My costume complete, I walked out of the dressing room as cocky as a male porn star, acting like I owned the place. I ran into Vince, who was getting a cup of coffee and catering. He looked me up and down, his eyes settling on my ridiculous hairstyle. It's cheap heat, Vince. Indeed. He nodded with a weird look on his face and strutted away. So that is what Chris Jericho is walking into. But don't forget, he is there at the same time as Jesse Ventura. And he and Jesse had run into each other years earlier. He talks about it in his book where Jesse had given some career advice. So this little reunion, Jericho really wanted to talk to the body and just to kind of thank him. So here's what went down. I went up to him and said, Jesse, I don't know if you remember me, but I met you in Winnipeg at a hockey tournament you played in with my dad. I told you I wanted to be a wrestler and you gave me some great advice that helped me get here today. I don't know if I expected him to jump up and down, pat me on the back, or give me the keys to Brooklyn Park, but he didn't give much of a reaction at all. He actually just kind of jobbed me out saying, good for you, kid. Another Jesse success story, before walking away with a cigar clenched between his teeth. Cigar clenched between... I don't know. There's just something so hysterical about that. But the success didn't come right away because I think the bar had been set so high. But let's take Jericho's entire career and where he is now, because he's living the absolute dream because he does what he wants when he wants to do it, and he's kind of developing his own character. You know, he's in WWE as the memorable List run where he's alongside Kevin Owens, and then they end up feuding. He takes off. He's worked New Japan more recently, and he's just shown up in all sorts of various places. The Jericho Cruise, I find rather amusing. I'm not sure I would want to buy a ticket on a Chris Jericho cruise, but again, to each his own. The way he came in, with the countdown clock, trading with The Rock, certainly one of the most memorable moments in Monday Night Raw. I know they had the top 100 when they had the Raw 1000 or something like that for all-time moments. I would certainly, not having seen much of Raw in like that 2003 to 2013 time period, it has to rank in the top 10 just for he's here from WCW. We poached one of their most entertaining and charismatic stars, and now we are going to put him on a stage with The Rock, our most entertaining and charismatic star of the time. Sort of like taking Ric Flair and Hulk Hogan and putting them in the same ring in 1986, but just from a pure charisma and microphone duel standpoint.
And I am the new millennium for the World Wrestling Federation. Now, for those of you who don't know me, I am Chris Jericho, your new hero, your and most importantly, the most charismatic showman to ever enter your living rooms via a television screen. Now, when you think of the new millennium, you think of an event so gigantic that it changes the course of history. You think of a dawning of a new era. In this case, the dawning of a new era in the WWF.
The Rock is not impressed.
Thank you. Thank you. The new millennium has arrived in the WWF. And now that the Y2J problem is here, this company, from the front office idiots to all of the amateurs in the dressing room, including this one, to everybody watching tonight, will never, ever be the same again.
Even though the face heel structure was kind of an afterthought in 1999, still kind of important that you're introducing him as a cocky, arrogant heel. They're not bringing him in as a babyface savior by any means. So you got to have somebody who is in the ring that the crowd is not going to turn against because of Jericho being so damn charismatic. And really, that kind of leaves The Rock, because I don't see Austin in this type of situation, because he's got his own thing going on, and also he's really on the downslide where it's getting to the point where they can't have the world title on him anymore because he's such an injury risk. So you have The Rock in there with Jericho. Like I said, like the dream match of just an interview duel. Two guys on the stick trading. And that means The Rock has got to get in his retort.
How dare you, little jabroni, come on The Rock show and not even have the class to introduce yourself? What is your name?
I told you
it doesn't matter what your name is. The Rock says you talk about your Y2J plan. Well, The Rock has a little plan of his own, and it's called the KY Jelly Plan.
Oh, no.
Which...
You know what that is, JR?
Yeah.
You do? You don't use it to clean pipe, JR.
Which means The Rock is gonna lube his size 13 boot real good, turn that some bitch sideways, and stick it straight up. You can't do that.
Jericho would get some measure of revenge later in the show when he would interfere in the Rock versus Big Show match that would then lead to the unfortunate beatdown of The Rock by Billy Gunn, which was the kaboom of the week when they went to commercial. Yes, Billy Gunn beating down The Rock on Raw and leaving him laying. And Rock did the whole, if you smell, la la. I mean, you've heard all that before. This is just tremendous stuff from start to finish. But I worry, and maybe I shouldn't worry about it because it is so good, that it set the bar so high for Jericho because it took him a while to really get going into that level. Some people might even argue that he never became a truly top star until his 2008 suit wearing run. And you can make a case for that. I mean, even if you use the night he beat Austin and The Rock to become the Undisputed Champion, that is not for over 2 years from this point. He's kind of slogging along in the IC territory, not at that main event level. He had the match with Triple H on Raw where he quote-unquote won the world title for a short period because of the fast count. But I think by any argument, given how he was brought in, you think he's going to run on top for years to come. Kind of like Hulk Hogan 1984 was huge in coming in, but that's an impossible standard to kind of match. That was a sort of once in everybody's lifetime sort of thing. And I don't mean Rock versus Cena once in a lifetime. I'm talking truly once in a lifetime. So I'm just going to take this for the fantastic segment that it was, and just enjoy the fact that Chris Jericho, in the 19 plus years since then, has carved out one hell of a career, and is kind of a role model for anybody coming up in the business with where he's at now. Get yourself to a point where you don't have to answer to anybody. Up next, we have the uncrowned Chikara Trios champions for the year 1999, probably because it didn't exist, in draws Prince Albert and Key. So I should run down, you know, these three people in case you have forgotten who they are. Albert, Prince Albert, as he was known at this time, because everything has to be about dicks back then, and Prince Albert was a form of genital piercing. That is Matt Bloom, the current NXT head trainer, who originally from Massachusetts, so he falls under the Winston corollary of I support him because he's from an area that I am. In fact, he's from Peabody, Mass, which is something that I would see on the highway signs all the time. There was a mall up there, the North Shore Mall. Peabody's next to Danvers. I worked in Danvers for a long time. I actually prefer Danvers to Peabody because they had the Liberty Tree Mall, which had the better video arcade when I was a kid. It's funny how I'd like judge malls back then by, number one, quality of the video arcade, and number two, quality of the food court. Draws is well known, was in Beyond the Mat, later paralyzed in an accident a couple of months later on SmackDown, which did not air. A D'Lo Brown powerbomb that went wrong, in part because of Draws' clothing being very loose and all that. He's the head guy in this stable. This is from a series of little interview vignettes or whatever called Draws' World, where he would explain things like Prince Albert is his personal tattooist, and Key, who is the third member, I should address who and what is Key. Key, what is Key? Key is supposed to represent the drug dealer of the group, because Key is supposedly a play on the word kilo. Honestly, they could have just gone with the name Graham instead, because a gram is another unit of measurement. I don't know why drug dealers use the metric system. I mean, they should get with the program like the rest of us and not use the metric system. Am I right, fellow Americans out there? So they're not very subtle about this. Whatever happened to the days of Razor Ramon, where, yeah, he's sort of a Scarface character, and he has the razor blade, which is not to connotate shaving his face, but rather to maybe cut up cocaine and to create lines of it on a table? I don't know. Who is Key, you're wondering, if you've forgotten, because this is literally the only time he would wrestle on TV. It is aspiring window washer, 36-year-old Vic Grimes, much older at that point than I would have thought. And poor Grimey, okay, as I said, aspiring window washer, but he'd get mixed up in scaffold matches with New Jack. That would sort of end his dream of becoming a window washer, because being up on scaffolds for him might not be the best place at the end of the day. I think there's a very important lesson here, and it's a rather simple one. Never put yourself in a position, and just generally never do scaffold matches with New Jack. He's sort of like Frank Grimes from The Simpsons in that he made a lifelong enemy of New Jack, but at least he didn't die like old Grimey did in the one episode that he was on. He's in all white, so his look is rather peculiar. And he looks like the deranged love child of Waylon Mercy and Luna Vachon. Like, as if the two of them got together and decided to have a kid who was now 36 years old. But Draws is equally ridiculous with this giant top hat. And I think by default, it makes Prince Albert, the normal one, the guy whose name is based on genital piercing, is the normal one out of this trio. And by the way, they're facing Adam Keen, Andrew McMurphy, and Tim Hawk, although I can't even tell the difference between any of them because they don't have any identifying characteristics. So we start out with Draws in there, power slam, but he pulls the man up at two because Draws knows that you don't want to end your TV match in 15 seconds because you got to give him time to talk about all your stuff and get some exposure out there. Albert with the bicycle kick big boot and a quick promo from the commentary team for this new show.
WWF Jacked, a new show, new look, new attitude.
Hopefully a new announcing partner.
And gotta be attitude if I'm on the show.
Oh yeah.
No word on if anybody would be sitting Shiva for Shotgun Saturday Night upon its cancellation. So Key finally gets into the ring. Freight train avalanche into the opponent. Again, I can't differentiate between any of these three guys. Saw a thing the other day that the NBA does not want to grant an expansion franchise to Seattle because they don't want a team playing in the Key Arena, which they must think is named after Key or was built by him or something, because it's not all that bad. I've walked past it in Seattle, but it could use a new name, and I know it's a corporate sponsorship. Albert springboards off Key's back after the freight train avalanche to kind of add a little bit to it. Hayes looks at Key and wonders if he is an ice cream salesman and wearing the all white. And Cole says he looks like the Michelin man. So some high words of praise for the newcomer. And his moves are somewhat decent because he is a guy in the mid 300 pound range who can move around a little bit. I mean, you can't. He certainly is fearless if he was willing to do scaffold matches with New Jack in not only ECW at Living Dangerously 2000, which is where they had the accident where New Jack got brain damage and became blind in one eye, but Key has an interesting little finisher here for his one match. He picks a guy up in what appears to be an inverted razor's edge. Interesting given the similarities to Razor Ramon that I mentioned earlier. But instead of kind of the slow drop down like the way Razor would do it, he just kind of slams him end over end, and that picks up the victory for the uncrowned Chikara King of Trios champions for 1999. Draws, Prince Albert, and Key, We Hardly Knew Ye.
It's why WWF action figures are sold separately. Hardcore figures for hardcore fans. WWF action figures and grapple gear for SummerSlam 99.
Playtime's over!
I wasn't getting any wrestling figures by that point, but what I remember that commercial most for is the little Triple H tag at the end. Playtime's over! I mock that dozens upon dozens of times with my friends watching wrestling. Kind of made me not take the guy very seriously after a while. I mean, maybe that's what delayed his push and why Mick Foley had to be brought in early 2000 to just risk life and limb to get this guy over as a top guy. So on to the next segment, which is another review of Raw, as if enough didn't happen. We look at Kane and X-Pac winning the tag team titles from the Acolytes, which is another thing I don't remember because the damn tag titles changed every single week. In this case, an X-Factor by X-Pac finished off Farouk. Tony Atlas and Rocky Johnson defeating the Samoans in late 83, this ain't. Because you just don't remember all these because it was such a hot potato. The titles changed twice more just by the end of the month of August 1999. In fact, I was there for one of them at the August 30th Raw in Boston, where the Rock and Sock Connection defeated The Undertaker and Big Show, who had beaten X-Pac and Kane at SummerSlam 99. Oh, a tag match with Undertaker and Kane in it? Gee, we're still doing that 19 years later, although I guess they're on the same side. I remember going to that Raw, and it was the start of my junior year at college, and I was going to be rooming with my friend Mike, and I knew he was going to be showing up at a certain point on one of the days. I want to say it was on that Monday, and I left the ticket in the envelope for him and said, yeah, we're going to Raw tonight, which in 1999 was kind of a big deal. But there was one additional thing for that match, which was Kane talking for the first time, at least without the aid of that weird thing that you always see in the anti-smoking ads where, you know, you plug it into your throat and it helps you talk. So what could Kane possibly have to say after all this time in his own voice? I'm going to guess, because they told him to say two words, I'm thinking he's going to say, vote Jacobs.
You don't need this damn thing anymore. Come on. Let's hear it without this thing. Come on!
Can't believe this. Kane's got two words for us.
Suck it.
I figured if he was going to go for shock value, he was going to say, eat me. And seemingly offended by all this, the Big Show and The Undertaker come down and beat up Kane and X-Pac, leave them laying. As I said, they would end up winning the tag titles at SummerSlam before dropping them on the August 30th Monday Night Raw at the Fleet Center in Boston. That song, Smooth, by Santana, featuring Rob Thomas on the vocals, was number one at the turn of the century from 1999 into 2000. So if you ever get a trivia question, a song that was number one in two different centuries, that is the correct answer. Up next, for our final bout, we have Steve Blackman, the successful spiritual cousin to Jerry Flynn, as I discussed last week. Although the techno music that would play for Steve Blackman was always kind of an odd fit. He doesn't look like the kind of guy that would be enjoying himself in a club. I mean, I can appreciate that. I mean, I was at some party where there was like loud thumping music, which I walked into because they let me and my friend Millmore in, but it was like the Young Republicans, so we like kind of looked around and made sure Brett Kavanaugh wasn't there. We left at that point. Fun Steve Blackman trivia. He was on the losing side in a 1988. Yes, 1988. I did not just mean to say 1998. 1988, so 11 years before this, of the only Islanders six-man match that included High Chief Afi and Tama alongside Haku. That is on the May 7th, 1988 Superstars. He was teamed with Brady Boone and Outback Jack, who was also making his last WWF TV appearance. Blackman's opponent here had me excited for a little bit when I saw the results in some places. He's referred to as the Striker, but it doesn't appear to be Matt Striker, because Matt Striker did not make his debut until the year 2000. I am reasonably confident in making this call, even though you can't really see the video all that well with it not being high definition or anything. However, if the Striker does pass a drug test, he will be the best pure striker in the World Wrestling Federation at that time. No wonder why The Undertaker ended up going away for a little while shortly after losing the tag titles at the end of August, because if this guy stuck around, he would have been the best pure striker in the company. Blackman was kind of an unlikely star in that he's not Ken Shamrock, because he's not coming in with all this hype, and he's not Dan Severn because he's not carrying 55 wrestling belts to the ring. Although that was the thing that I loved about Dan Severn, is the whole he has a lot of belts. He became way bigger, Blackman did, than Dan Severn for a variety of reasons that I can't quite put my finger on. I think it's the fact that he was adaptable into that badass character who would use the kendo stick as a weapon, whereas Dan Severn was kind of a plain guy that if you threw him back in 1971, you could throw him in the ring with Carl Gotch. But this is a completely different era and Dan Severn just was not a fit for anything that WWF was trying to do. As much as I was hoping that a pure wrestler out of MMA, like Severn, out of the UFC, would make it, it just didn't happen. But it did for Steve Blackman, for whatever reason. Like I said, he's the good Jerry Flynn, because Flynn was doing a lot of the same stuff in WCW, but never even came close to this level. Backbreaker by Blackman, who then gets on the second rope and says, "Who's the man now?" Which, I'm wondering, was that D'Lo Brown's catchphrase? He might be preparing a cease and desist letter for Blackman to not do that anymore. Get a small package as a hope spot by the Striker, who isn't doing a whole lot of striking in this match. And I notice, because it's 1999 WWF, it goes without saying, a lot of Irish whips in this match. And he's got the bicycle kick that we also saw earlier from Prince Albert. As I was watching this, I could not remember what Steve Blackman's finishing move was. And so it was kind of exciting, because I was like, I have no idea how he's going to actually finish this match. And he does with a wrist lock submission hold, and that is how he picks up the victory here on Shotgun Saturday Night. And they actually just quickly wrap it up. There's nothing else. They just say, you know, we'll see ya, and then you get the little copyright 1999 in the corner with the Scratch Attitude Era logo, and that is indeed a wrap for WWF Shotgun Saturday Night for August 14th, 1999. No edition of Vinny Vegas Corner this week. I've been doing picks on a little private ESPN thing, as I've done for about 10 years against the spread, and I'm really not happy with my record so far this year. I don't know if it's just that I'm less invested in the NFL than I was, say, 6 or 7 years ago, when I used to do really good at that sort of thing and really cared and would listen to all sorts of podcasts to try to gain insight towards the NFL. Maybe that did help me back then. And now I don't care as much. Also, you know, the flags for Roughing the Passer, although hopefully that will dissipate going forward, I think. Maybe it will return at some point in a few weeks. I am looking forward to the championship series round in Major League Baseball, the Dodgers and the Brewers and the Red Sox and the Astros. I think those are going to be two very good series, even though I think that the Astros will beat the Red Sox in 5 games. Much as I hate to pick a team that is employing Roberto Osuna as one of their main relievers. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, you could just Google Roberto Osuna Toronto and you'll find exactly what I mean. My heart says Brewers in 7 over the Dodgers, but my head says Dodgers in 6. So I think we're headed for a rematch of the 2017 World Series, unfortunately, because, you know, I'd like to mix it up, and the Brewers have not been to the World Series since 1982. It was my sports moment in 82 when he gave up the tying hit to Keith Hernandez. So it'd be nice for them to be back there. And I like the idea of the Astros meeting the Brewers in the World Series, because in 1997, those two teams were in opposite leagues from where they are now. So it'd be kind of fun for those of us who actually remember that. And I have one piece of business left here, and that is another edition of YouTube Comment Theater. Now, as always, these are actual comments made from presumably actual YouTube users on this video, which appears to be somewhat hidden in plain sight on the old YouTubes. Not as many views as you might think for something that is 1999 WWF. I know I was talking about how it's not rewatchable for me or for a hardcore fan, maybe, but for somebody who's a little bit more casual, who remembers the Jericho debut on Raw and other stuff happening around this time, they might be searching something like this out. So let's start here with Christian Molina, who says, "I'm surprised they kept the 97 Shotgun Saturday Night intro and the Block logo." Well, the intro is actually slightly different, and You're probably not going to work to create a new logo for a secondary show like this. You're just going to go with whatever's there. I mean, hell, I haven't even changed my logo for this show because I don't think about it all that much. And I'd like to do an artist rendition at some point, but I'm not entirely sure what that will be. Probably something to do with a television set, the initials GFA, something like that. Andrew Justice says, do more professional wrestling videos. Thanks. I always love the people who are like, and it's not directed at the person who posted the video, who, by the way, it's the only video they've posted on YouTube to date. Anthony STN says, need more. Another one in that vein. Ninja Student says, glad the opening got better than the old one. Yes, the old theme with more with like the shotgun noises and kind of the quick music is replaced by like the woman dancing in what appears to be like a nightclub or whatever. It's a different kind of motif, and it certainly fits what the WWF was doing in 1999. Christian Molina replies to that. The theme actually fits the intro, and it does. I would have to agree with that. And then finally, Gene Bone, I wonder if that's Ken Bone's brother, the guy from the presidential debates in 2016, he says, triple nose is cringeworthy. And yeah, not only with the whole, I'm going to kick your ass, like, Triple H doing stuff that guys today are not allowed to do in his maniacal race to get over that took 3 or 4 years for him to get to that level that he finally got to in 2000. But it's just that ridiculous toy commercial, playtime's over. Like, why would you agree to say a line like that in a commercial when you're trying to be taken seriously as this bad wrestling heel or whatever? Or at least do another take. Is that the only take they got of Triple H saying, playtime's over? It's just so utterly ridiculous. That'll do it for YouTube Comment Theater. As always, I ask that you leave a 5-star review on iTunes, Apple Music. That is always appreciated. It provides social proof that you are listening to and enjoying this program. And also, leave 5 stars for the entire Pro Wrestling Only feed. Now, as for next week, I'm going to be going back to the 80s, finally, after a few weeks here in the 1990s, a couple weeks in 1999, which I never thought I would do, go back to 1988. For some NWA Worldwide Wrestling from February 6th, so Jim Crockett Promotions. And a couple of interesting things are going on there as the WWF is running the Hogan-Andre main event the night before. Mike Rotunda winning the NWA television title from Nikita Koloff, but I don't really care about that so much as who the referee was in that bout. I will discuss that. Sting kind of gives his little how-do-you-do introduction to Ric Flair, J.J. Dillon, and the Four Horsemen in a little incident. And also another edition of According to Larry, because, yes, he has turned up in the National Wrestling Alliance and has also won a title. And, of course, it is the greatest title of all time, the Western States Heritage title. So do join me next Thursday for that. Thank you so much for listening once again. And do tune in next Thursday for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
Playtime's over!